very good day ahead.
Today is Thursday, December 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinua Ofo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, President Biden speaks again Thursday with Vladimir Putin on demands for security guarantees in Eastern Europe.
After meeting with Putin earlier this month via video conference, the president said the U.S. and key NATO allies would discuss Moscow's concerns about the alliance.
The World Health Organization warns the rapid circulation of the Omicron and Delta variants is leading to a, quote, tsunami, unquote, of cases.
WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says while science had led to the development of COVID-19 vaccines, the global death toll from the disease keeps rising.
And Iraq's political parties negotiate the composition of the country's next government. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. President Biden will speak again Thursday with Vladimir Putin as the Russian leader steps up demands for security guarantees in Eastern Europe. Associated Press correspondent Sagar Magani reports from Washington.
After meeting with Putin earlier this month via video conference, the president said the U.S. and key NATO allies would discuss Moscow's concerns about the alliance.
And whether or not we could work out any accommodations as it relates to bringing down the temperature along the Eastern Front.
An estimated 100,000 Russian troops are massed near the Ukrainian border, fueling fears of an invasion. Putin said this week he will ponder options if the West does not meet his demands, which include keeping Ukraine out of NATO. Washington says that's a non-starter. A senior administration official says the president will stress to Putin that while the allies are united, he is willing to engage in principled diplomacy with Moscow. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Longtime Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, Nevada's longest-serving member of Congress, has died. AP correspondent Tim McGuire reports.
Democrat Harry Reid was Senate Majority Leader during the administrations of both President George W. Bush, a Republican, and Democrat Barack Obama. In 2016, as he was leaving the Senate, Reid talked about the highs and lows of leadership.
There have been times when I've been terrified, frustrated, but you know, the terror and the frustration passes quickly.
Reid was known as a fighter and tough negotiator during his decades in office. Former President Bill Clinton noted that his work in the Senate resulted in millions of Americans living better lives. Reid's wife of more than 60 years, Landra Reid, says he died peacefully following a four-year battle with pancreatic cancer. He was 82. I'm Tim McGuire.
The World Health Organization warns that rapid circulation of both the Omicron and Delta variants of the coronavirus is leading to a tsunami of cases, severe diseases, and surging deaths among the unvaccinated. Lisa Schmidt reports for VOA from Geneva.
WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says while science had led to the development of COVID-19 vaccines, the global death toll from the disease keeps rising. In 2020, the World Health Organization reported 1.8 million deaths globally, a number that pales in comparison to the additional 3.5 million deaths reported in 2021. Tedros says the reason for the climb is that politics too often trumps the need to work together to defeat this pandemic.
Populism, narrow nationalism, and hoarding of health tools, including masks, therapeutics, diagnostics, and vaccines by a small number of countries, undermined equity and created the ideal conditions for the emergence of new variants.
Tedros condemns the misinformation and disinformation that often is spread by a small number of people for undermining science and trust in life-saving health tools. He says these twin evils are driving vaccine hesitancy and are to blame for the disproportionately large number of unvaccinated people dying from the Delta and Omicron strains of the coronavirus. He warns the virus that causes COVID-19 will continue to evolve and threaten the health system if nations do not improve their collective response. He says it is time to rise above short-term nationalism and protect populations and economies against future variants by addressing global vaccine inequity.
Ending health inequity remains the key to ending the pandemic. As this pandemic drags on, it's possible that new variants could evade our countermeasures and become fully resistant to current vaccines or past infection necessitating vaccine adaptations.
The WHO chief says it is time to banish the politics of populism, and self-interests are derailing the global response to the pandemic. As 2021 reaches its end, Tedros is asking everyone to make a New Year's resolution to get behind WHO's campaign to vaccinate 70% of the world's population by the middle of 2022. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has significantly revised downward the approximate percentage of new COVID-19 infections in the U.S. caused by the Omicron variant of the virus. According to the agency, Omicron accounted for about 59% of all U.S. infections as of December 25th. Previously, the CDC said the Omicron was responsible for 73% of all cases for the week ending December 18th. Now, the number has been revised to 22.5% of all cases. Dr. Amish Adaja, a senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security in Baltimore, Maryland, and an infectious disease physician, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that when a doctor diagnoses a case of COVID-19, there's no way to tell what kind of variant is causing the infection in the person sitting in front of them.
Our regular diagnostic tests don't give you that. You can sort of get a hint with some PCR test results, but many people get diagnosed with antigen tests. The way we understand what variants are causing what proportion of infection is through a process called sequencing, which is done at the CDC, at some state and other public health labs, as well as some universities. And in the United States, we don't sequence every case that gets diagnosed. It's in the single digits. So when you get that small fraction, that sampling, that's really not necessarily always going to be representative of what's going on in the country as a whole, because it's going to have some geographic bias to it and all of that. So they take those numbers and make statistical inferences to try and understand what the proportion would be in the United States. And there's often a wide range that they're not able to give you an exact number with a lot of confidence. And that's what's happened with Omicron. Is early on, they had stated in mid-December that about 73% of our cases were estimated to be caused by Omicron, and they revised that number down to 23%. That's a big drop, but it reflects the fact that we are not very good at sampling for sequencing to figure out which variant is causing an infection. And we are somewhat lacking such situational awareness when it comes to which variants are circulating where. But from a clinical perspective, other than the difference in the monoclonal antibodies, you are not able to really tell what a person has, and it doesn't necessarily change the treatment except for Omicron and two of the three monoclonal antibodies that are approved.
What about the overall number now that we're seeing a surge all across the world in most places? Would you say that the Omicron variant is largely the reason?
In many parts of the world, the Omicron variant is the reason why there's an increase in cases. But for example, in the United States, we had an increase in cases prior to the arrival of the Omicron variant because of the Delta variant. But in general, we have to expect that cases are going to increase for some period of time. And cases are not necessarily going to have the same importance going in the future as they have in the past, as more and more of the population becomes immune, as more and more of the population gets vaccinated, as we get more tools like antivirals and monoclonal antibodies, there's going to be a shift of focus to severity of infection, to cases that require hospitalization. And I think that's the right focus because this is an endemic respiratory virus that is not going to be eliminated. It's not going to be eradicated. It's going to be with us forever. And the goal is to shift the spectrum of illness towards the mild side with all of our knowledge, with the tools that science and medicine have given us.
What do you make of efforts by governments around the world to try to curb, at least, the surge in these kinds of cases? Some are talking about lockdowns, while others are talking about forced vaccinations or making it a mandate. What do you think of that?
Lockdown should never be the solution that people run towards. They have very negative cascading impacts on everything, every element of society, and they really are not justified this late in the pandemic. Vaccine mandates are very controversial. My personal position is that companies, organizations, they should want all of their employees, all the participants in whatever activity they may be having to be fully vaccinated. I think it's much more palatable and preferable when it comes from private businesses making this decision on their own than when it comes from government. When government makes vaccination a condition of life, it becomes very difficult, first of all, to enforce. It becomes something that gets mired up in courts. It's something that creates a lot of backlash and protests. And I think it's probably not something that governments should do. I think if a company or organization wants to have vaccines as a requirement, I think that makes sense. And I would applaud them for doing so. But when the government gets involved, I think it becomes a very problematic issue. And I think there are clear concerns about violations of individual rights when it happens in those situations.
That's Dr. Amish Adaja, senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security and an infectious diseases physician. He was speaking with my colleague, Carol Van Dam. With Iraq's October parliamentary election results now ratified, political parties are negotiating the composition of the country's next government. Observers say they see alliances between different groups changing, not based on ideology, but on narrow political interests. The central focus now is on who will become Iraq's next prime minister as the country struggles over its future direction. Dale Gavlak reports from Amman, Jordan.
The election victory by nationalist Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr has the potential to break Iran's grip on Iraqi politics, observers say. Osama al-Sharif, an Amman-based Middle East political commentator, says al-Sadr is one of Iraq's few political figures calling for the dissolution of armed pro-Iranian militias. Writing in the Saudi Arab News Daily, al-Sharif said al-Sadr's Sayyarun alliance is the only one brave enough to denounce the political quota system and the rampant corruption beleaguering the new Iraq. And perhaps that's precisely why al-Sharif said Iraqi voters gave al-Sadr's parliamentary bloc 73 seats at the expense of pro-Iran blocs such as Hadi al-Amri's Fatah coalition, a political front for the pro-Iran militias. But Iraqi journalist Mina al-Oraibi, writing in Dubai's The National Newspaper, says that despite al-Sadr's win, he does not have a majority. Given the shifting alliances, she wrote, it is unclear whether he can pull together a majority in parliament to name the next prime minister, who will be tasked with forming the future government. Al-Arabi and other observers say they would like to see Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Khadami maintain his position, saying that al-Khadami still represents Iraq's best chance at stability. Senior analyst Nicholas Harris with the New Lines Institute in Washington says there are no guarantees at this time that al-Khadami will keep his post.
There is a distinct possibility that Khadami will be replaced, although there's no clear answer to who his replacement would be. Now, fundamentally, Khadami came into office in the spring of 2020 as a sort of compromise candidate. The Iranians, the Americans, the Shia, the Sunni, the Kurds, other groups could all sort of come to agreement that he was the best of whatever was available in terms of options. And there's still the sense that Khadami could play that role.
Journalist Al-Arabi says Al-Khadami's strength as prime minister is that he is not beholden to a political party and is largely seen as a nationalist, not swayed by ethnic or sectarian beliefs. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
Lebanese President Meshaal Aoun expressed outrage in his speech on Monday that the country's cabinet has not met for over 2 months. The situation is due to demands by Hezbollah for Judge Tarek Bitar to be removed from Beirut port blast case before they agree to a cabinet meeting. This as the nation suffers from a worsening economic crisis, including a delay in negotiations with the International Monetary Fund. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi discussed the veto power of Hezbollah in Lebanese politics with Joe Macaron, a Lebanese-American political analyst.
First, the nature of the sectarian system in Lebanon, especially in the last two decades, when ministers from a certain sect boycott the cabinet meeting, a lot of debates about whether it's constitutional to be held or not. And this has been part of the governance crisis in the past two decades. If all the Shiite ministers are absent, or all the Christian ministers are absent, or the Sunni are absent, whether a cabinet meeting can be held and whether it will be representing the nature of the system. And this is one of those crises. Definitely the arms of Hezbollah, the political and military weight they have in Lebanon, gives more significance to this veto. So this is why we had Meshaal Aoun disrupt the governments before. We had many instances where the cabinet was prevented from meeting. But this shows that Hezbollah is standing with its allies and it reflects the difficult relation between Hezbollah and the President Aoun. The alliance is shaky now going into the parliamentary election, and it shows the weakness of Mikati, the new prime minister, who's unable to save his government because he also have allies with the parliament speaker, Birri, who's close to Hezbollah. So it reflects, I think, the complicated and difficult dysfunctional Lebanese system now, and it shows that any party, especially the traditional one with significant weight, can disrupt the country and the government without any repercussion, especially during an economic crisis.
The Lebanese president referred to a number of issues preventing the country's government from operating as the nation suffers from a worsening economic crisis, including a delay in negotiations with the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, and the blockage of the cabinet from meeting. What is the way out? First, from the political stagnation. Second, from the devastating economy in Lebanon.
To put it simply, we shouldn't expect any breakthrough before the presidential elections. The country now is basically in those calculations now. I don't expect anything on the IMF talks. The government is not meeting to pass a budget. There's still a big divide on the numbers that are giving to the IMF. So we shouldn't expect any major breakthrough on economic collapse is continuing gradually, and there's no clear government plan on how to get out of this. And on the political stagnation also, this government is very weak, as expected. It's unable to give the basic services or basic governance because of the political stalemate due to the foreign intervention and due also to the nature of the political class, the corrupt level that they have. So I don't see a way out before we get to the election. First, the parliamentarian, if it was held on time, and second, the presidential. We should expect delays on this even. So I think everybody is in this mode, and the U.S. and Iran are not willing at this point to concede this political crisis to have a real breakthrough between the two. And the complicated aspects also of the Lebanese political system and the nature of the oligarchic system. So yeah, I don't see any major breakthrough before the presidential election next year.
That's VOA senior analyst Mohammed Elshenawy speaking with Joe McEwan, a Lebanese-American political analyst. In other news, Hong Kong's pro-democracy Stan News online media outlet says it is ceasing operations following a police raid and arrest of current and former editors, board members, and a journalist. The outlet issued a statement Wednesday saying its website and social media are no longer being updated and will be taken down. He says all employees have been dismissed. Police raided the Star News office earlier in the day after arresting seven people on charges of conspiracy to publish a seditious publication. The move is the latest in an ongoing crackdown on dissent in the semi-autonomous Chinese city. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Apo in Washington. Tidal waves and coastal erosion have submerged an entire fishing village on Ghana's eastern coast. Many villagers already have been relocated because of past tidal waves, and they have petitioned the government for a permanent solution. Sinanu Todd reports from the village of Fuveme in Ghana.
The RC primary school lays in ruins after what authorities say in November was the largest tidal wave to ever hit Ghana's eastern coast. It was the third relocation of the school further inland after two previous ones were completely submerged, along with the Fuveme fishing community. Fuveme's assistant headman, Knowledge Diwonu, says no matter how many times the villagers move further away from the shore, flooding and coastal erosion have brought it right back.
So it started in 1997, mm-hmm. and it did not destroy all the land. It destroyed part of it. And in 2016, it also destroyed part of it again. And in 2018, then it destroyed all the land at Fuveme. So you can't see anybody at Fuveme now. So these are the village near to the Fuveme, which is now being destroyed by the sea again.
The once thriving fishing village of 2,500 people has been reduced to a few hundred who are struggling to keep their heads above water. A United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization, UNESCO study, says 37% of Ghana's eastern coastal land was lost from erosion and flooding between 2005 and 2017. Emmanuel Gamaga, chief executive of the coastal town of Keta,
blames rising seas from climate change as well as human activities, such as building dams and ports and harvesting sand from beaches to sell for use in construction.
So as the chairman of the MISEC, the Municipal Security Council, we held a meeting and we came out with an order which seeks to ban the fetching of the sand from the beaches until further notice.
In a meeting with authorities, Fuvema villagers said the ban was not enough. Seji Saji Amedonu, the deputy director of the National Disaster Management Organization, calls for building a sea defense wall, as has been done on some other areas of the coast.
The whole shore of Ghana, from Axim to Aflawu, that protection needs to be done, because if we protect one particular place and leave the others, the devastation will continue.
While all coastal West Africa suffers from erosion, Ghanaian experts say their country's long coastline, almost 550 kilometers, that's 350 miles, makes it most vulnerable. The University of Cape Coast Center for Coastal Management says Ghana's shoreline moves inland an average of 2 meters annually. Sena Anutod for VOA News, Fuvema Village, Ghana.
Groups in Kenya are pushing authorities to resettle tens of thousands of squatters evicted just ahead of the holidays to make way for a Chinese-backed expressway. Brenda Mulinya reports from Nairobi.
Kenyan Lucy Wangare, in her 40s, cleans a makeshift tent that has provided her family flimsy shelter since October, when Nairobi city authorities evicted them from their home of almost 2 decades. She, her husband, and her sister spend the holiday season living in the tents, enduring cold and wet nights. City authorities evicted more than 40,000 squatters like Wangari from Mukuru Kwajenga slum and razed their homes to make way for construction of the Nairobi Expressway. What is left of the Mukuru slum looks like a wasteland, with scores of makeshift tents forming a small island. Authorities gave them just days' notice to vacate their homes, says Wangari. If you look at where I sleep, she says, you'd think I wasn't a Kenyan citizen. You'd think I was a refugee. Wangari says they used to have property and houses, but right now they've been left destitute. She blames Kenya's government. The $500 million elevated expressway aims to ease Nairobi's notorious traffic by connecting the main international airport to the city center and the wealthy suburbs. The Chinese state-owned China Road and Bridge Corporation is building and financing the expressway, which should be working in 2022 and will collect the tolls for nearly 3 decades. Despite critics calling it a road for the rich, Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta defended the project while taking a tour of it the day before Christmas.
The difference that is being occasioned by the road building, by the drainage being put in, by the sewage being put in, I do believe that within another 2 years, Nairobi will be a truly 21st century city, catering for its population in a positive manner and in a manner befitting our people.
But Kenyan right activists fought the government for not striking a balance between the need for infrastructure and human dignity for those evicted. 25-year-old Anami Daudi is with the Mukuru Community Justice Center.
It's so traumatizing. People are having mental issues here. We have other special challenges here. They should get like special attention. But you find out that even the facilities that we have around, they can't maybe even accommodate or maybe to create that space to provide such services.
The single squatters left homeless like 38-year-old Pauline Gathoni struggle with security fears. It's very dangerous to spend the night here, she says, especially for us women. Gathoni says the men can defend themselves if attacked, but she can't fight anybody. If someone attacks me and steals my property, tells me to leave, she says, I will have no choice but to obey them. City authorities promises to compensate and help resettle the evicted families have yet to come true. Brenda Molinya for VOA News, Nairobi.
This is Science in a Minute.
The James Webb Space Telescope continues its voyage to its home in space after its successful Christmas morning launch from French Guiana. Webb is heading toward what is known as the second Lagrange point, or L2, which is about 1.5 million kilometers from Earth, opposite the direction of the Sun. According to NASA, Lagrange points are areas in space where the gravity of the Sun and Earth balance the orbital motion of a satellite. As it travels through space, Webb is going through a series of steps where critical segments of the space telescope, such as its sunshield and its primary and secondary mirrors, are deployed. The JWST is expected to reach its space home toward the end of January. You can track the space telescope on the Webb Internet page at web.nasa.gov. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
They're still trying to figure out what are the specific policies from the White House.
VOA Asia, your daily digest of top Asia stories.
Beijing has especially hazardous levels of air pollution.
Blending American and Asian perspectives.
China is protecting wildlife.
Original reports and series, education, health, technology. Stories that mean something to your daily life. VOA Asia.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage on world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu in Washington, wishing you a pleasant day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In early December, the Biden-Harris administration released the first ever U.S. strategy on countering corruption. By doing so, the United States reaffirmed that fighting this global scourge is a key domestic and foreign policy priority of the United States government. Speaking in Ecuador in October, Secretary of State Antony Blinken enumerated some of the reasons why corruption is such a destructive force. Corruption is estimated to cost up to 5% of global GDP. It stifles growth. It discourages investment. It deepens inequities, he said. But maybe its greatest toll is on citizens' trust in government.
In fact, if you look at the vast majority of broad-based civilian uprisings around the world in recent years, the Maidan in Ukraine, Tahrir Square in Egypt, from Romania to Tunisia, from Sudan to Guatemala, you will find at their core a total revulsion at corruption. It affects people in every aspect of their daily lives. And it drains resources from the state that could be spent and dedicated to a school, to a hospital, to something that actually improves lives of people.
On a national level, the new strategy to counter corruption addresses vulnerabilities in the U.S. financial system that corrupt actors may exploit. On a global level, the strategy lays out how the United States is integrating anti-corruption measures into U.S. foreign assistance, multilateral diplomacy, security partnerships, and bilateral relationships. The counter-corruption strategy stands on five pillars. To begin with, the United States will modernize and improve the coordination of U.S. government efforts to fight corruption. It will also allocate the issue more resources. Second, it will address gaps in the U.S. regulatory system and work with international partners to do the same. Third, the United States will work to minimize illicit financing and hold corrupt actors accountable. Fourth, it will work to preserve and strengthen multilateral anti-corruption architecture. And finally, the new counter-corruption strategy seeks to employ diplomatic engagement with foreign partners to prioritize anti-corruption efforts. This includes leveraging foreign assistance to advance transparency, accountability, and anti-corruption reforms. Corruption threatens United States national security, economic equity, global anti-poverty, and development efforts, and democracy itself, said President Biden. But by effectively preventing and countering corruption and demonstrating the advantages of transparent and accountable governance, we can secure a critical advantage for the United States and other democracies.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This is the voice of America. Washington, ba 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 zip.